congregations shouted even above the festive Christmas carols being played. One nigger down and eight to go. 21. Negro girl is suspended from school after incident. Arkansas Gazette, Wednesday, December 18, 1957. My hopes for a blissful 2-week respite from Central High over Christmas vacation have been dashed by the dilemma we all faced because of Minnie Jean's suspension. By dumping the chili over the white boys' heads, whether accidentally or not, she had opened a door through which segregationist leaders announced they would eject all of us. It was the beginning of the end of the Little Rock School integration, they said. Immediately, cards and flyers appeared all over town reading, "One nigger down, eight to go." Her suspension notice stated Minnie Jean could not begin the process to apply for readmission until 6 school days had passed. Classes would resume on January 3rd of the new year. Our greatest fear was that Superintendent Blossom would use this opportunity to get segregationists off the school board members' backs by refusing her re-entry. Segregationists had long been threatening a recall of the school board. If the board denied Minnie Jean readmission, they might stave off that recall and save their jobs. So instead of the peaceful, happy, safe Christmas vacation I had dreamed of for months, I was embroiled in integration meetings and worry. It was that nagging kind of problem that stays at the back of your mind, no matter what else is going on. Will they or won't they let Minnie Jean back in school? And if they don't, what will it mean to the rest of us? Local and national NAACP officials were alarmed because they saw the incident as the first sign of significant progress in the segregationist campaign to get us out of school. It jeopardized the progress they had worked for so many years to realize. The outcome of her case could affect not only the Little Rock case, but all integration efforts across the South. If expulsion were a way to stop integration, segregationists would make it their weapon. As I entered the living room early one evening, Grandma was setting up the manger scene, gingerly placing each of the crudely carved wooden figures that had been handed down from her mother. She wouldn't allow any of us to help for fear we'd drop a piece. What with all her baking and decorating and gift-making, this was her favorite time of the year, next to spring planting. "Did you see that nasty letter on the front page of the Gazette telling businesses to stop advertising in that paper?" Grandma asked. "I sure hope nobody listens." "It's a sign the segregationists have begun their campaign on a whole new level," she said. "They're gonna dig in folks' pockets now." "I guess they're pretty hopping mad at the Gazette," Mother Lois said, breezing into the room. "They're accusing that paper of breaking down segregation laws with its attitude." She made a funny face as she continued, "I don't know how they figure that." "Well, anyhow, that great lambasting in the paper ought to prepare you for what they just might plan for Minnie Jean. You've got to get ready for it," Grandma said. I wondered what awful thing they could possibly have in store for us. "You've been a bit down-spirited lately," she went on. "When did worry ever make anything happen your way? Minnie Jean either is or is not going to stay in school. Worry won't fix it." I took a deep breath and sank into the couch, waiting for Mother Lois to get dressed for a party we were to attend to honor the Little Rock Nine. "Where are you going?" Conrad asked. "Mama and I are going to a grown-up Christmas party," I answered. I didn't want to make too much of it because I figured he was beginning to feel left out, what with all the fuss being made over me in newspapers and magazines, and now a party planned in our honor. The National Organization of Delta Sigma Theta, a professional women's sorority, had decided to give us a Christmas party at the Dunbar Community Center. It was the first time some of my own people were saying a public thanks to us. It lightened some of the pain I felt for all those who were critical of our going to Central. As I entered the community center, sorority women, showing off their high fashion and high spirits, greeted us as though we were very important. They had made us their secret project, with members of the nationwide organization mailing gifts and loving notes from across the country to be presented to us that evening. I was bursting with pride as people said nice things about my courage and about what we nine were doing for future generations who would be able to attend integrated schools. It wasn't the kind of party where you have teenage fun, but it was wonderful just the same, especially because I had so few opportunities to socialize. Minnie Jean's suspension was only mentioned in passing. Despite that worry, we nine enjoyed each other as friends, once outside the pressure we shared at Central High. We compared our gifts, of course. My favorite was a carved mahogany jewelry box. I'll keep this forever and give it to my grandchildren, I thought to myself as I carefully placed it on the nightstand beside my bed later that evening. In my diary, I wrote, "Tonight I feel love from my own people. Everybody tried to make us happy. There is the tiniest flicker of hope and joy inside me. Maybe things will work out. Please, God, won't you allow Minnie Jean to come back to school just this once? I promise I'll help her be stronger."
I see where Mr. Bennett is applying pressure to that interracial human rights group, bugging them to give up their membership records again,
Grandma said over breakfast the next morning as she folded the newspaper.
"You know, he and that law he got passed are becoming more than just a nuisance. He's doing some real damage."
As Grandma read snippets of information from the paper and discussed it with Mother, we noted alarming and increasing examples of segregationists applying pressure to our people in new and different ways. They were systematically attacking on all sides anyone who might support us in any fashion. However, I wasn't going to let it bother me today. This was one of my favorite times of all, the family's annual last-minute Christmas shopping spree in downtown Little Rock. We had avoided going there for a long time, afraid I might be attacked. But I wasn't about to let the integration steal my Christmas shopping trip. I argued with all my might. I could wear a disguise. Stores couldn't afford to invite trouble that might interfere with sales. On and on I went. "Thank God I'd won," I whispered as we all piled out of the car. Looking around, I was absolutely awestruck by the holiday decorations and music that surrounded us. Inside, the stores were filled with Christmas magic and all the delightful things I had seen in magazines that I so desperately wanted but seldom could afford. On this one very special day of the year, as a Christmas treat, Mother Lois gave us each $25 to shop. She asked that we remain within shouting distance of her and Grandma while we browsed. As always, the white clerks gave me dirty looks whenever I touched the merchandise. They had only recently allowed my people to try on clothes in a few of their stores. They behaved as though they begrudged our being there, even though we were going to hand our money over to them. Having all that shopping fun enabled me to ignore their disapproval.
"Hey, a nigger without a soldier guard."
It was the boy who had threatened to kill me ever since I kicked him in the crotch. My first thoughts were to shout for help, to run away, but I couldn't let him think I was a coward.
"We've only got 8 niggers in our school now,"
he spoke very loud to the boy standing beside him.
"We're getting rid of the others, too. But this one here, She's not going to live to go anywhere. Yeah, Andy. If you get her out, you get that big prize money everybody's talking about. Ain't no money going to make me feel as good as killing her, Andy said, glaring at me. Frantically, I searched for a way to get us all safely out of the store. Trying to behave as though I were not alarmed, I casually examined items that lay on the counter nearest me. When I had moved a short distance away from Andy, I quickened my pace. Just then Conrad approached me. Grabbing him by the collar, I tried to signal him that something was wrong, but he didn't understand. Hey, Melba! Let's put our money together and buy this new game. Look, it's got... The thud of my heart racing in my ears drowned out his words. I hoped his excited voice would attract Mother and Grandma, but it was Andy who responded to him. Two niggers. I wonder what I'll get for both of them. Andy moved toward us. Don't you call my sister a nigger! Conrad was yelling back at him. I hoped their voices wouldn't cause a store-wide fracas. This way, Grandmother India said, shoving us ahead. Hurry, Mother said. Conrad protested in a loud voice as we quickly hustled to I didn't know where. This isn't the way to the front door, I protested. Move it, girl, Grandma whispered. All at once, I realized where she was going, the restroom. Great, I thought, we'll be temporarily safe there, but then they'll call the police and we'll be trapped. Once inside, I had to catch my breath and bring up a polite smile to greet three ladies from our church who stood preening themselves in front of the mirror. Gracious Lois, that boy is old enough to do his business with the man, said Sister Floyd. Annoyance on her face. My baby is just a little ill. I'll have to tend him. Grandma shoved Conrad into a stall, beckoning Mother to come closer as she whispered to her. I imagined a big, ugly scene where policemen arrested us as Andy and a crowd of hecklers cheered. Mother didn't seem as frightened as she ambled up to Mrs. Floyd and started a conversation about the Christmas social. As the ladies headed for the door, Grandma ushered Conrad and me to follow close on their heels. Sure enough, Andy and his friend stood just outside the door looking like angry lions waiting to devour prey. Grandma glared at them as she said, Why, my goodness, I guess you two gentlemen are forced to make a pathway so the seven of us can squeeze past. The scowls on their faces melted into sour frustration as they eyeballed the church ladies and slowly backed off. Sister Floyd weighed at least 250 pounds. Sister Laney probably weighed a tad more, and Sister Belle was no slouch, what with her sleek, athletic 6-foot body. After we had traveled some distance, I looked back to see Andy and his friend following us, but not up close. Well, young lady, from now on, you can just give me your list and I'll take care of it. I don't know what we would have done without the sisters, Mama said as we piled into the car and looked all around us, taking deep breaths. It was the Christmas spirit that lulled us into letting our guard down, Grandma grumbled on the way home. Going downtown, seeing all the people shopping and the decorations had always been one of the best parts of my holiday celebration. The segregationists had stolen yet another important piece of my life. They had taken away my Christmas shopping fun. The day before Christmas, the Gazette carried two major local stories: White Christmas Banned at CHS and 13 lawsuits pending over integration. I was reading the articles as Conrad and Mother Lois prepared to go shopping without me. The first story about White Christmas embarrassed me. How could they assume we didn't know the difference between white snow and white folks?
The second article said the federal courts were deluged by new filings and a backlog of cases on the racial integration issue. They would all be settled in the next months before the start of the new school year. Some of the issues to be ruled on apply to our case. If the judge ruled against integration, our surviving all the brutal punishment at Central would be in vain because they would use those rulings to kick us out of their school. When Mother Lois and Conrad left for downtown, I told myself being left behind didn't matter anymore. At least I was grateful that I didn't have to go to Central that day. Besides, nothing could make me sad with Christmas so close and Grandma rattling paper and hiding gifts while I felt safe and snuggled warm, watching television as I dusted the living room. Christmas Eve was delightful as we sat sipping hot chocolate and wrapping gifts to place under the tree. Each of us traded a personal gift. If during the year one of us coveted something that belonged to another, we might get the temporary loan of that item for January of the new year. We especially looked forward to those gift notes in our stockings. For example, I was thinking about granting Conrad the privilege of using my stereo twice a day for 1 month, but I wasn't certain I could be that generous, so I wrote, "maybe," on my note to him. Vince called to say he would come by on Christmas with Mother's permission. The thought of our being together near the tree on that special day, listening to carols, really sparked romantic daydreams. But as always, my daydreams were so much better than the reality of being with him because we now had very little in common. He still spent most of his time questioning me about Central and teasing me about being a celebrity. Of course, like lots of young people and adults, he teased me about Minnie Jean's chili incident. It made me feel uneasy about continuing to like him so much. If he really understood what I was going through, he should realize that the chili incident was a big crisis in my life, one that worried me every moment of every day. I began to wonder whether I was better off just being with Vince in my daydreams. Each day of vacation, Minnie Jean and I spent time on the phone or on visits, talking at length about what might happen to her. The more we talked, the more we realized it was something we could do little about. The final word rested with Superintendent Blossom. Later that evening, Papa Will came by to bring his presents. I hadn't seen much of my father since the integration began, but this time he was in a good mood. He didn't bother to say, "I told you so," even though his awful predictions about integration causing trouble had for the most part come true. He was pleasant and genuinely concerned. The best part was the surprise he had hidden on the front porch, a brand new television set with a big screen. He had chosen a special small gift for each of us. The fact that he put lots of time and thought into the gift selection made me feel that despite the way he had behaved, maybe he really did love me. He and Mama looked at each other fondly for just an instant, and it felt as though we were a family again. I sometimes prayed they would get back together. At first, Conrad and I had hoped against hope. As the years passed, we watched them grow apart in odd ways that made us sad. Rumors around church were that Papa even had a girlfriend now. But just for an instant, Conrad and I eyed each other, both thinking how nice it would be if he stayed. Maybe they would go with us to the family dinner and announce they were getting back together. But then Papa looked at his watch, cleared his throat, and off he went as though he had an important thing or person to get back to. As Mother walked him to the door, I heard her invite him to our family Christmas dinner the next day at Aunt Maydell's house, but he said he didn't feel comfortable there. Dear Diary, it's Christmas Eve, and Papa's not coming home to stay. For 9 Christmases now, I've prayed he would be with us. Maybe it's not gonna happen. Could I please have a nice new stepfather? Thy will be done. By next Christmas, either I want things to be a lot better at Central, or I want to be somewhere else. Please, God. Merry Christmas. Christmas dinner with the family was the biggest occasion of the year, a time when we spent the day catching up on family love and bloodline gossip, as Grandma called it. We were 27 laughing, chatting people. I had waited all year to see all the relatives who weren't at Thanksgiving. Even though all of them had definite opinions about my adventures at Central High, I vowed not to talk about it. No matter what it took, I wanted to pretend life was normal again. I wanted the feeling of Christmas before integration. By late evening, as we sat in front of the fire singing Christmas carols, I realized maybe I had my wish. I hadn't felt that content since the summer before in Cincinnati. Little Rock Story, second on AP's best list. Arkansas Gazette, Sunday, December 29th, 1957. The stories range from number one, the launching of Sputnik, to Nikita Khrushchev emerging at the top of the Kremlin, the Teamsters Union hearings, Hurricane Audrey, President Eisenhower's stroke, Asian flu, and the passage of the Civil Rights Bill. How strange, I thought, to be involved in something that the whole nation considers among its 10 most important stories. If it's that important, you'd think somebody would be able to do something to make the Central High students behave themselves. Is it that nobody cares, or nobody knows what to do? By New Year's Eve, I only thought about Central High perhaps every other hour. Vince had invited me to a party, but of course Grandma and Mama said no. Besides, our famous shadows, Mutt and Jeff, were parked across the street, faithful as hound dogs in their vigilance. Although we discussed reporting them to the police, we knew full well that might bring on more trouble. So we simply lived with their being there, watching us. Mother didn't like my coming and going at night, even when the party was in my neighborhood. Only on rare occasions did any of us go out after dark. Once dusk came, we locked all the doors and windows and closed the curtains. So on New Year's Eve, I sat home completing my list of New Year's resolutions. 1. To do my best to stay alive until May 29th. 2. To pray daily for the strength not to fight back. 3. To keep faith and understand more of how Gandhi behaved when his life was really hard. 4. To behave in a way that pleases Mother and Grandma. 5. To maintain the best attitude I can at school. 6. To help Grandma India with her work. 7. To help Minnie Jean remain in school, to be a better friend to her. 22. Those first school days of the new year were frightening without Minnie Jean, because it made us realize anyone or all of us could be next. Posters and cards reading, "One nigger down and 8 to go," were everywhere. Segregationists left no doubt that they were seizing Minnie Jean's suspension as an opportunity to fire up their campaign. Governor Faubus was adding to our insecurity and revving up segregationist hopes by publicly announcing that the school board should file a petition asking the courts to delay integration. He cited a recent order to that effect in Dallas, Texas, as evidence that Little Rock could do the same. He also constantly threatened to call a special session of the legislature to enact segregation laws unless the feds would immediately take us out of school and halt integration. Once we got back into our daily routine, it was evident that segregationists must have spent their holidays thinking up ways to make us miserable. I could feel their electrifying hope of victory all around me. They walked differently, talked differently, and didn't hesitate to shower us with angry words and deeds, letting us know we were short-timers. I had by then withdrawn from French class because I wasn't able to concentrate with the combined pressure of the extremely hostile students and coping with everything else. I was also concerned that I couldn't do my best in my English, shorthand, and typing classes, all of which would have been a breeze under any other circumstances. Even before lunch on our first day back, we had all begun to experience a hell we could not have imagined. The rumor was that the White Citizens Council would pay reward money to the person who could incite us to misbehave and get ourselves expelled. It was apparent that many students were going for that reward. Boys on motorcycles threw an iron pipe at the car in which Gloria and Carlotta rode to school. Inside school, the group of students whose talent was walking on my heels until they bled met me after each and every class to escort me to the next. I would speed up. They would speed up. I couldn't escape no matter what I did. Ernie and Jeff were bombarded with wet towels, and boys overheated their showers. Gloria and Elizabeth were shoved and kicked. Carlotta was tripped in the hall, and I was knocked face forward onto the floor. Thelma was spared some of the physical abuse during that period because of her petite stature and fragility, but even she was jostled. One of the ever-present and most annoying pastimes was spraying ink or some foul-smelling, staining yellow substance on our clothes, on our books, in our lockers, on our seats, or on whatever of ours they could get their hands on. We complained long and hard to the NAACP. Tufts at CHS draw NAACP fire. Arkansas Gazette, Friday, January 10th, 1958. Thurgood Marshall, chief counsel for the NAACP, said Little Rock officials should get tough with the 40 or 50 hardcore white students causing trouble at Central. The toughs are still pushing our kids around, spitting on them and cursing them, he said. On Monday, January 6th, Minnie Jean and her parents met with Superintendent Blossom. She was allowed to return to school Monday, January 13th, with the proviso that she not respond to her attackers in any way. I drew a deep sigh of relief as we discussed the good news by telephone that evening. Fine, I said to her. You can do it. I tried to explain to her what Grandma India had said about freedom being a state of mind. I tried to impress upon her that our being able to make it through the year was the biggest talk back and fight back we could give them. A short time after Minnie Jean's return, a boy doused her with what appeared to be a bucket of soup. She froze in her tracks and did not respond, even as the greasy liquid trickled down her chest and horror painted her face. Afterward, a group of perhaps 50 students gathered outside the principal's office to shout cheers for the douser, saying he had paid her back. He was suspended, but we were frightened that he had set in motion an all-out soup war that could lead to the drenching of each one of us and guarantee a real brawl if we tried to fight back. On January 11th, a white girl was also suspended for pushing Elizabeth Eckford down a flight of stairs before a genuine adult witness, a teacher. She was punished, but the others who pushed us downstairs were not. Headlines in the newspapers told of some of the other perils we faced over the next few days. January 15th, Guard platoon sent to school after threats of bombing. January 17th, another racial clash reported at Central High. January 21st, dynamite found at CHS. Blossom sees campaign to try and close school. January 22nd, Another bomb scare disrupts CHS routine. Blossom appeals for the end of threatening calls. January 23rd, CHS plagued by more bomb scares. January 24th, new bomb scare at Central High proves false. January 27th, another bomb tossed at L.C. Bates' house. The segregationists were becoming even more vocal, urging the students to harass us at every opportunity. The Central High Mothers League announced a nighttime rally with the Reverend Wesley Pruden, president of the Citizens Council, speaking on what race mixers are planning for us. They issued a special invitation to Central High students. We heard that almost 200 hardcore segregationist students protested our presence by being absent from school on the day of that rally. In addition to all the other indignities and physical pain we endured, we were now taunted by large groups of students who picked certain days simply to stare at us. They came to be known as stare days. Large, boisterous groups of hecklers stared intensely and harassed the living daylights out of us. On several occasions, 70 or so students showed up at school wearing all black to protest our presence. Those were known as black days. The segregationists organized a systematic process for phoning our homes at all hours of the night to harass us. They also phoned our parents at their places of work and any other relatives or friends they could annoy. One day, Terrence's mother rushed into the principal's office, having been called and told her son was seriously injured, only to find the call had been a hoax. Repeated bomb threats were telephoned to our homes. Somebody was also calling in reports to the news media that Minnie Jean had done outrageous things, like running nude in the school's hallway. Time after time, she was devastated by reporters' inquiries about some bizarre thing she was said to have done in school and gotten away with. Those stories, when printed, only served to agitate students who had already made it their life's work to get her out of school permanently. Late one afternoon, Minnie Jean was waiting outside school for her ride home when she was kicked so hard she couldn't sit down for 2 days. That incident was embarrassingly painful to her in many ways. Her bottom was discussed in the newspaper and by people as though it were an object without attachment to her body, and that hurt her feelings. That incident made her the victim of ridicule. Whenever we spent time together, I could tell she was growing more and more weary. I feared she couldn't take much more of the constant mental and physical pounding. And yet, school officials seemed unwilling or unable to stop the war being waged against her. I remember a moment near the end of January when I was struck by the fact that all the school officials were increasingly nervous and behaving as though things had gotten out of control. Even the soldiers of the Arkansas National Guard seemed fearful of what could happen in the hallways of Central. Their presence had always only added to our problems. Now, we saw mirrored in their faces a reflection of the danger that surrounded us. I could also see the fear in Mrs. Huckabee's eyes. Somehow, in the course of time, she had become our liaison to the other school officials. Even though she was the vice principal of girls, she was the one person we all, both male and female, reported our problems to. Not that she could do anything about them, but she would usually listen. We had also come to trust her, at least to be as fair as she could under the circumstances. I thought that she, too, must be under a lot of pressure. During those late January days, we had kept the door to her office swinging. We would meet each other coming in and going out with our complaints, sometimes teary-eyed, sometimes smoldering with anger. On January 27th, I wrote in my diary, "The National Veterans Organization has awarded us the Americanism Award. They think we are heroines and heroes. Why are we only niggers to beat up on to the students at Central High? I don't know if I can make it now. It's really, really hard. Why should life be so hard? When will it ever be fun to live again? We had real evidence that school officials weren't certain of their ability to protect us when, on the day of a pep rally, Mrs. Huckabee suggested that Thelma, Minnie Jean, Elizabeth, and I sit in her office rather than be exposed to the hostility and physical abuse that certainly awaited us. We were having more frequent meetings with Mrs. Bates and other NAACP officials about our problems. Despite our conversations and all the public declarations that school officials could protect us, the truth was, things were getting worse by the moment. When it came to Minnie Jean's suspension, segregationists were like sharks who tasted a drop of blood in the water. Their determination to have their kill, to see her gone, brought us to an impasse. If some resolution were not found, it seemed certain all of us would be forced to leave school within the week. Mrs. Bates says 9 Negroes won't quit despite trouble. Arkansas Gazette, Wednesday, January 29th, 1958. As determined as everyone else was to have me remain at Central, with each passing day I began to doubt that I was strong enough to tough it out. Even as I watched the others weaken, I could feel myself growing weary and nervous. When I had a long period of time alone on a Saturday, I leafed through the pages of my diary. I had not been fully aware of how deeply the turmoil at school was affecting me. I was stunned to see what I had written. "I wish I were dead." That was the entry for several days running in late January. "God, please let me be dead until the end of the year." I was willing to bargain and plead with God. I revised my request. I just wanted to become invisible for a month or two. I clutched the diary to my chest and wept for a long time. "No," I whispered aloud. "I do wish I were dead. Then all the pain and hurt would be over." I fell to my knees and prayed about it. That's when I knew I should go and talk to Grandma India. I told her about my wish to be dead. "Good idea," she said. She didn't even look up at me, as though she were alarmed after I whimpered out my confession. Instead, she continued dusting the dining room table. My feelings were hurt, and then she looked me in the eye and said it again. "Good idea. How did you plan going about it?" "Ma'am?" I wasn't certain I'd heard her. "I said I wish I were dead. Did you hear me?"
"And I said good idea."
Her voice was louder as she peered at me with a mischievous expression. "The sooner you get started, the sooner you'll make the segregationists real happy. They'll love broadcasting the headlines across the world." She braced the palm of one hand on the table to balance herself as she paused for a long moment to think.
"I've got it. The headlines will read, 'Little Rock heroine gives in to segregationists, kills herself.'"
"What do you mean?" I gasped. I felt really angry that she talked as though she didn't care. She kept on creating new headlines about my death.
"Or maybe they could write, 'Melba Patillo died by her own hand because she was afraid of facing God's assignment for her.'"
"Oh, no, ma'am." I slumped down into a chair. She wouldn't let up.
"Then, of course, there would be the celebration all the segregationists would plan. Let's see now. I'll bet they would rent the Robinson Auditorium for their party. It would be kinda like the wrestling matches, you know? Loud, with all the cheering, singing, and dancing.
She looked back down at the scratches on the table and continued dusting.
So, do as you please. But I'd also think about that moment at which you'd have to face the Lord and explain your decision to him.
She ignored me, humming her hymn. I'm on the battlefield for my Lord. I stood there for a moment watching her. That did it. I realized dying wasn't a good idea. I was almost certain God wouldn't allow people to die for only a short while and come back. After that, Grandma arranged for a daily time when I had to come to her room, get down on my knees, and pray with her. Then she and I would talk about what was troubling me and what I would like. We would play Yahtzee or read pages from some fun novel I would choose. Sometimes we'd read through the newspaper together, but only the good things, like the launching of an American satellite into orbit that circled the Earth in 116 minutes. During those days, I felt so close to her, and I knew I had been silly for wanting to give up. Several times she looked at me and said, "Don't you know, child, how much I love you? How much your mama loves you? Whenever you think about going away from this earth, think about how you'd break my heart and your brother's heart. You might as well take your mother with you, because she'd be beside herself." She made me get a project I really liked and encouraged me to keep on top of it. I chose the blast off of the Explorer, the satellite that put our country into the space race. I had always been interested in rockets and space. Once, I had run away to the Strategic Air Command base in a nearby town to see if they would allow me to become a pilot. Grandma studied up on the topic, and we talked for hours while she taught me how to do the quilting for Mother's birthday present. Meanwhile, Mother Lois urged me to give Vince a standing invitation to Sunday supper. I couldn't understand why she was being so nice. I think Grandma talked to her about our conversation and was trying to cheer me up. Sometimes Vince came even when I didn't want him to. There were times when I just wanted to stay in my room and think, because I had no energy or desire to do anything else. Everything in me was devoted to being a full-time warrior. When I wasn't actually on the battlefield, surviving, I was thinking about how to do it or worried that I wouldn't be able to make it. Every day, Grandma and I prayed hard for Minnie Jean to have strength and peace of mind and for all of us to be able to feel God's love for us, even in the face of those who spewed so much hatred our way. For the second time on Thursday, February 6th, Minnie Jean was attacked by the boy who dumped soup on her. During the ruckus that followed, there was a great deal of confusion. The identity of who attacked and who fought back was not clear. Her attackers accused her of retaliation. "White trash," were the words they reported her to have said. In addition, they accused her of throwing a purse at a girl. When she was sent home without receiving a suspension notice, I breathed a sigh of relief. But at the end of the day, Mrs. Huckabee gave Carlotta a sealed envelope to be delivered to Minnie Jean. 23. "They bother you all the time," ousted Negro student contends. Arkansas Democrat, Thursday, February 13th, 1958. In the article that followed, Minnie Jean explained the pressure she had been under at school. She said she had only had half a white friend at Central, a two-faced girl who ran hot and cold. Of the other students, she said, they throw rocks, they spill ink on your clothes, and they call you nigger. They bother you every minute. I cried for an hour when word came that the envelope sent to Minnie Jean was a suspension notice. I was devastated when Superintendent Blossom said he would recommend her expulsion. But when the NAACP and her parents announced they would push to have a hearing, I kept a glimmer of hope. Back at school, I didn't have very much time to be sad. We were under siege, at the mercy of those who saw Minnie Jean's expulsion as their victory, and evidence they could immediately get rid of all of us. I was warned that since I had been Minnie Jean's good friend and, like her, I was tall and not at all shy, I would become the next target for expulsion. One nigger down, eight to go. Cards and signs flooded the school. We couldn't turn around without somebody pushing a card in our faces or chanting awful verses at us like, she was black, but her name was brown, and now she ain't around. Attacks on us by hostile students increased. I read in the paper that Thurgood Marshall said he didn't know how much more unpleasant treatment we could take at Central High. That night I wrote in my diary, I sometimes wish I could change myself into a psychiatrist to determine what makes me such a hated member of this school. Can they really be treating me this way simply because I am brown? That's all? Ooh, no, no, I heard myself shout as I was walking up the 14th Street stairwell one morning. It wasn't yet 8:40, and I was already the victim of a dousing with raw eggs from someone standing on the stairs above my head. The odor bothered me, but even more, it was the feel of that slimy substance oozing very slowly through my hair and onto my face, while at the same time raw egg slithered over the sweater Aunt Maydell had given me for Christmas. I stood still, wondering what to do and where to go. I felt so humiliated, I prayed that a huge dark hole would appear in the floor and swallow me up. The niggers come to have breakfast. I can tell. She's wearing eggs, one boy called. I never said a word back to the group hovering with their ugly catcalls. I knew they were just hoping I'd do or say something that would result in my expulsion. I backed down the stairs and out the door to go home. Well, this egg is wonderful for putting moisture in the hair, Grandma said. Some people use it for that, you know. Maybe we ought to start it on a regular basis. She was trying to wipe out as much as she could. Then I would have to bathe and wash my hair. Hold still, she continued. After a nice long bath, you can hurry back to school. And this will have been just a refreshing break in your morning. I've never been so embarrassed. Oh, I'll bet there've been other times, and there'll be more. Embarrassment is not a life-threatening problem. It can be washed away with a prayer and a smile, just like this egg is washed away with a little water. I know, but it's the same way I feel when they spit on me. I feel like they've taken away my dignity. Dignity is a state of mind. Just like freedom. These are both precious gifts from God that no one can take away unless you allow them to. As Grandma spoke, she motioned me to turn my head to the other side. You could take charge of these mind games, you know. How do you mean? Take, for example, this egg in your hair. Suppose you'd have told the boys who did this, thank you, with a smile. Then you've changed the rules of the game. What they want is for you to be unhappy
That's how they get pleasure.
Yeah, but that would be letting them win.
Not exactly. Maybe it would defeat their purpose. They win when you respond the way they expect you to. Change the rules of the game, girl, and they might not like it so much.
They think I was crazy.
They think you are no longer their victim.
For the rest of the morning, I walked the halls amid my hecklers. I couldn't stop thinking about what it would be like to feel as though I were in charge of myself. I always believed Grandma India had the right answer, so I decided to take her advice. As I tried to open a classroom door, two boys pushed it closed. At first, I tried to pull it open, but then I remembered changing the rules of the game. I stood up straight, smiled politely, and said in a friendly voice, "Thank you. I've been needing exercise. You've done wonders for my arm muscles." I chatted on and on as if they were my friends. They looked at me as though I were totally nuts. Then they let go of the door. I felt great power surging up my spine like electricity. I left them standing there, looking at each other. During lunch, I learned Ernie and Terry had been the victims of yet another devilish deed. While Terry participated in gym class, someone took his school clothes and dumped them in the shower. Ernie had so much trouble with students stealing his gym clothes that he bought his own, which he carried with him in a briefcase, until someone wrested it away and stuffed his clothes into the toilet in the girls' restroom. On February 14th, Valentine's Day, it snowed. That afternoon, as we stood in the snow waiting for our ride, we were attacked with snowballs filled with rocks. Mr. Eckford, Elizabeth's father, bolted from the car to rescue us, but he, too, was bombarded. Little Rock's finest police officers and members of the Federalized National Guard stood by watching with their arms folded as we were hit time after time. Even when we pleaded for their assistance, they did nothing. When I arrived home, Grandma handed me a large, oddly shaped envelope. "I suspect it's a special greeting from that young man you ignore most of the time. After all, it is a special day." I took the envelope to my room to open it. It was a card from Vince. As I read the beautiful words, I was sad that I couldn't talk to him on the phone or see more of him. But for the life of me, I couldn't fit him into my schedule. Even my daydreams about him were beginning to fade because integration was taking up all the space in my mind. Three CHS pupils suspended. Minnie Jean Brown expelled. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, February 18th, 1958. Minnie Jean was expelled after a 40-minute hearing. The official announcement of her expulsion, coming after all that had been done to stop it, was a devastating defeat for us. The fact that the school board at the same time suspended three white pupils, two for wearing one down, eight to go cards, and one for pushing Gloria down a flight of stairs, didn't lessen the blow. The NAACP had counted on getting Minnie Jean's expulsion reversed, but Blossom and the school board were adamant in sticking to their conclusion, despite all the pressure on them. National NAACP officials arranged for Minnie Jean to have a scholarship to a famous private New York high school called New Lincoln. She would live with the family of a renowned psychologist, Dr. Kenneth Clark. I had read that it was his research that had supported Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP's legal suit that resulted in the 1954 Supreme Court decision to integrate the schools. It was a fabulous opportunity for her, but all I could think about was how far New York would be from Little Rock. We would no longer be able to get together to have our usual talks. At the same time, I tried not to be jealous that Minnie Jean would be escaping the hell that was my daily life. Still, I found myself daydreaming about what it would be like to get on that airplane with her and go to a place where there was no central high school, no segregationists, and no pain stinging my heart every time someone called me a nigger. I imagined that she'd have normal dates with nice boys, a real junior prom, and friends who smiled at her and talked with her every single day. She wouldn't be lonely anymore. But most of all, she wouldn't have to be frightened all day long that somebody was going to hit her, say nasty things, or even try to kill her. Late one afternoon, a few days before Minnie Jean was to leave, I sat on the side of her bed, watching her pack. The two of us were talking and giggling. Again, I was overwhelmed with those mixed feelings. I desperately wanted her to stay, and at the same time, I would have given anything to go with her. She was showing me her wardrobe, gifts from friends to help her adjust to her new life. They were the most beautiful clothes I had ever seen. Angora sweaters in deep autumn shades of rust and green, with matching corduroy skirts, a few of those wonderful fuzzy collars everyone was wearing, a velvet blazer, and even a beautiful trench coat. I was so sad I could barely speak, but I was pretending everything was all right and that I was happy for her. What I really wanted to say was, "I miss you already. I love you like a sister. I don't know what I'll do without you." But that would sound too mushy, so I kept my thoughts to myself. Suddenly, she slumped down onto the bed amid all those beautiful clothes and her new luggage and started to cry uncontrollably. "I'm really sorry all this is happening. It's going to make it hard for the rest of you." I tried to console her. "It's not your fault, Minnie Jean. I'll miss you." She embraced me. "I'll miss riding home with you and playing records with you and, yeah, but look at where you're going. New Lincoln High School is a famous place. Those are rich people you're staying with. I'll bet you get your own phone and maybe even a car. You'll meet important people. Do you forgive me?" "There's nothing to forgive. But for the grace of God, it might have been any one of us." To distract myself from the tears welling up inside my heart, I began folding things to put in her suitcase. "If you don't pack, I get to keep all these gorgeous things and go away, and you'll have to stay here in my place," I teased. With the announcement that Minnie Jean was definitely out, the segregationists went wild. The signs on the wall said, "All niggers go north." An article in the newspaper announced hall patrols by federalized National Guardsmen would be eliminated, although they would remain in the building and make periodic checks. That announcement granted segregationists more permission to have a field day with us. The school days that followed were noted in my diary in terms of the particular indignities I suffered. Putting every detail down on paper would give God a chance to see for himself what was going on, I thought. February 18th, 1958. A red-haired, freckled-faced girl, the one who taunts me in homeroom, keeps trailing me in the hallway between classes. Today she spit on me, then slapped me. Later in the day, as I came around a corner, she tripped me so that I fell down a flight of stairs. I picked myself up to face a group of boys who then chased me up the stairs. When I told a school official about it, He said she was from a good family and would never do such a thing, and I needed a teacher to witness these incidents if I